and you're listening to Unusual Sources on 93.3 CFMU FM. And last week, we promised you we would interview Phil Taylor from the Taylor Report on the subject of the big news about what's happening in the Congo. Very important things happening in the Congo and pertaining to Rwanda as well. So what we have done is I think we've kept our promise, and if the equipment is working right, we should have Phil Taylor on the line with us today. Phil, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, you are. You're just coming in a bit faint. I'll have to adjust the volume.
Pick up.
That's a bit better. That's a bit better, Phil. It's the old phone lines here, see?
Yes.
Well, anyway, I'm glad I can hear you now. As we know, we've spoken with you on a number of occasions about events in Africa, particularly Rwanda, Sudan, and Congo. And your radio program at CIUT was given an award as one of the top censored stories of the year. I think it was 2006 when you were discussing Congo.
Yes.
Project Censored gave you that award because the crisis in the Congo was not being discussed very much at the time, even though it had killed up to 5 million people. And so you were trying to draw attention to this enormous crisis. And now finally, we've been hearing in the news a big spate of articles and stories about Congo. It seems to have died down a bit for the time being, but finally people are starting to pay attention. And I guess the question is, in what context should we understand things? Because it's happening at the same time as this trial that's being discussed about this woman, Rose Kabuyi, someone who had been connected with Rwanda's government and military in France. This all harkens back to the situation in Rwanda, 1990 to 1994.
Yeah.
Could you just review in terms of the current Prime Minister of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, and how he came to power as a result of those events?
Well, he's the president, actually, but of course he's the central personality, if you want to track him to know what is going on in, at the moment. The most observers, including the UN, and I want to say along the way that, of course, we take everybody's statements with a grain of salt, but almost all parties agree that the so-called rebels of East Congo, and East Congo is a big piece of real estate, an army there of more than 2,000 well-armed, well-outfitted men, complete with artillery, that they didn't just, when they're called rebels, they're not very descriptive, because it's the opinion of most observers that these are people who had been recruited, trained, and armed by Paul Kagame's regime in Kigali. And, of course, this would not be... And, of course, once again, he denies, says he knows nothing of it, which, of course, in a way is almost comical, because if anybody knows something, he knows it. So if when he says, I don't know, I don't have anything to do with it, it's almost a kind of an answer that reveals how much he does, because he doesn't tell us what he does know. It's his border that these so-called rebels are operating on. Their leaders are seen in and around Kigali, where Kagame is the president. And, of course, your listeners should remember that the man we're talking about, who's called now General Nkunda, he was once... being made a general seemed to be kind of easy in this situation. He was... In 1993, many years back, he was an RPF soldier/officer. I actually don't know whether he had rank or not, but he fought on the side of Paul Kagame's forces prior to the great havoc and showdown and violence and war of 1994. So he's a long-standing operative of Paul Kagame's forces. So... He does have a background. So once they seized power in 1994, they supported an invasion of what was then known as Zaire. And he participated in that. He was one of the lieutenants who was supporting Laurent Kabila, a so-called Congo rebel who operated out of Rwanda. And in 1997, they invaded Zaire, and this man Nkunda was one of the inner circle with Kabila. Now, at that time, by the way, Paul Kagame said he knew nothing about that. He said, oh, that was just Kabila. It wasn't him. It wasn't his army. But people said, well, it is your army. He said, no, it's not my army. So that attack on Zaire resulted in the overthrow of Mobutu, the president of Zaire, and everybody thought that was a good thing, except that it seemed to lead to a very interesting new problem. Laurent Kabila became the president of Congo. He renamed his country Congo. And then he did the unexpected. He said the Rwandans had been involved with his so-called rebel forces, and he said he appreciated their help, but he would like them to return to Rwanda because the people of the Congo would not accept to be ruled by Rwandan, primarily Tutsi element, although I don't think the ethnic aspect is crucial, but they were Tutsi. He's speaking to a political problem because the Congolese in Congo, the Tutsi minority, is very small. So here they were in the inner circle of now Kabila's government in Kinshasa. Well, the Rwandans objected to being asked to leave, and they then put down Mr. Kabila as an enemy of Rwanda, and mounted a new attack. They first of all left, went back to Rwanda, regrouped, and then attacked again. And again, Mr. Nkunda was a part of the invasion. I think the year was 2000. And the second offensive, second war, got the soldiers of the Rwandan, Ugandan, and Burundian armies made it all the way to the gates of Kinshasa. That is entirely the other side of the country. They marched from Central Africa, the Great Lakes region, all the way to Kinshasa. And when they got there, they were confronted by not just the Congolese forces under Kabila, but by soldiers from Angola and soldiers from Zimbabwe and soldiers from Namibia. And this is a very important part of the story because the sovereign, recognized, internationally recognized state of Congo had been invaded by Rwanda and Uganda, and they exercised their legal, internationally recognized right to call on allies and friends to help them defend their country against foreign aggression. And that aggression was coming from Rwanda and Uganda primarily. So the uninvited were Uganda, Rwanda, and the invited, legally appropriate soldiers from Zimbabwe, Angola, Namibia were there and defeated the Rwandan invaders. And I remind you, Mr. Nkunda was there, and his invading group, of which he was just a member at that time, was driven out, driven back across Congo and out. Not entirely, though. They got as far as East Congo, and that's where Mr. Kagame, with shorter lines of support and political help, was able to help them establish a kind of toehold and hold on to East Congo. Mr. Nkunda then was given a new role. What happened was they said, okay, we have a ceasefire, and we will now have an election. Because they said, well, Laurent Kabila is illegally in power. He got power. They would know. They put him in power with an army. So they said he's illegally in power. So they said, okay, well, let's have an election. And they had to accept that because they always claim that they're acting in the name of democracy. You never find anybody who doesn't claim he's fighting for democracy. So they all said they're fighting for democracy. And there were three rebel groups in East Congo, and Nkunda led one of them. Well, they had an election in East Congo. They had an election in the Congo. And the new president elected was Joseph Kabila. That would be the son of Laurent. Laurent, we're not going to bother ourselves with a side story, but Laurent was assassinated and led to this crisis where they had the result was going to be, let's have an election. So they had the election. It was internationally observed, and Joseph Kabila was elected president of the Congo, not not West Congo, but the Congo, all the way to the Rwandan border. And in the area where General Nkunda is functioning today and where he was sitting at that time as a rebel, in that region, the vote was overwhelmingly in support of Joseph Kabila, the president of Congo. So he is the legitimate president of Congo, and he is especially legitimate in the region now claimed by this armed group supported by Rwanda.
You know, it's very interesting. There's interesting parallels between this current General Nkunda and Paul Kagame in many ways, because...
Yes, well, it's like father, like son, and...
It's almost history repeating itself as farce, because...
Over and over and over.
You had Kagame coming into Rwanda as someone who had been supposedly an ex-member of the Ugandan army.
It was, in fact. There's no disputing it.
So
he doesn't deny it.
No, he's an officer, leading man. He basically invaded Rwanda and became its president. And then you have a situation where...
And by the way, just a footnote on your point. He invaded from Uganda.
Yes.
And the president of Uganda, Museveni, said at the time, "I don't know anything about that."
Yes.
It has nothing to do with me.
Just like Kagame is doing right now in relation to Nkunda.
It's really the same thing. You know, I want to introduce a really sinister chapter aspect to this for your listeners. This guerrilla, so-called, I haven't hit on the right word for what he is, but he's got a mercenary army anyway of 2,000 men. Again, they have the latest in uniforms, they have the latest in weapons. But he's saying that he doesn't accept the central government, despite the fact there was an election, and the people he supported lost the election. I mentioned there were three guerrilla groups. Two of the three said, no, we accept Joseph. He won the election, and we accept the democratic will of the people, but not him, because he is answerable, apparently, to Paul Kagame. But he did say something which everybody better pay close attention to. Like Paul Kagame, his mentor, he says that he will overthrow Kabila. He has threatened to destroy the government of Kinshasa, which is about 1,000 miles away from him, to the west. And people laugh. I wouldn't laugh, because that's exactly what Paul Kagame did. Paul Kagame had a little piece of strip of territory in the north of Rwanda, and they were negotiating his participation in a new government. And he said, if I don't get what I want, I will destroy the government in Kigali. And people thought, oh, well, of course, he can't do that. Well, he did it. And when Nkunda says, I will destroy Joseph Kabila, the elected president, take him seriously. He'll do it. And he'll do it because he will have powerful people, far more powerful than Paul Kagame, by the way. The United States is extremely... deeply involved here, and they intend to have their way, and I don't see anybody stopping them.
Well,
they intend to remove Joseph Kabila in some kind of machinations. They've already hit. Laurent Kabila is dead. They took care of that, but now they would like to take over all of Congo.
Nkunda.
And of course, let's again. You said at the top that there are minerals. This is a mineral-rich area. It has been the source of background of all this violence all along, going way back to King Leopold. And you can read Mark Twain's King Leopold's soliloquy if you want all the details. You can read Roger Casement's report when he was working for the equivalent of a modern human rights organization at the turn of the beginning of the 20th century, but it's a long, bloody story, and it involves colonial powers, and the one colonial power that is most passionately committed to Paul Kagame is the United States.
The current news has been focusing on Nkunda and many of the human rights violations that he's...
He's been found to be in violation by everybody. Mary Robinson, people remember her name, she's former president of Ireland, and then she was... Human Rights Commissioner of the United Nations, and she brought charges against him. He had been responsible for a massacre in the Congo of 160 people, specifically for which he was responsible. When she sent investigators, she said that she added to her charge because her investigators were abducted by Nkunda's forces and they were beaten in order to discourage any further investigation. So he's got a long, bloody history.
He's an interesting man.
He's a Pentecostal. He wears a button, Rebels for Christ. Curious man.
Well, I mean, I've read that Nkunda and his army are supported in some ways by Christian fundamentalists in the United States.
As you'll find them all over Africa. Where you have a violent thing going on, you're going to find American evangelicals who seem to be awfully interested in people trying to overthrow central governments.
Same in South Sudan, of course.
South Sudan.
But the other thing is, you mentioned the difficulties with international institutions. I've also read Nkunda engaged in firefights with the United Nations as well. But
he has no compunction about that. He knows he has immunity.
The degree of foreign involvement with Nkunda is fairly clear because when you read the news articles, the people in the Congo, in the region where Nkunda is, don't appear to support him. They don't seem to know him. They have bad things to say about him. They distance themselves from him. And his own forces speak English. Many of his rebel or whatever forces they are, they speak English instead of the French or other languages in the region. I mean, and you mentioned the weapons, and they clearly are better equipped and better trained than the Congolese military in general. It very, very much resembles a force that's being supported from outside, especially given Nkunda's ties to Kagame as far back as Uganda. I read in The Guardian, I think it was, that General Nkunda was an intelligence officer in the RPF.
Yeah, whether he was or not, I don't know. He's RPF, I think, had him on the shelf to put to use when they needed him. He is a criminal, of course, by any standard in Congo. What was he doing? He was living, he claims to have been a Congolese, a Tutsi living in Congo, who decided to go to Rwanda and attack a government that was friendly to Congo at that time, 1993. Congo and Rwanda were allies. So he leaves home country to attack a neighboring country, and then later he invades his own country three times, three separate invasions in which we have the figures, an international consensus of upwards of 4 to 5 million dead people as a result of these three incursions, illegal, into Congo. So, I mean, from the point of view of the Congolese government, this is a pure, unadulterated criminal. But he's being propped up by British U.S. media as now they put a suit on him. He's out of his uniform and he's wearing suit. So that makes him a gentleman.
We've mentioned some of the ties with the Anglosphere, I suppose you could call it, with the United States and in England. It's very interesting because there was the case that Rwanda itself moved away from the Francosphere and from the French towards the English. They even joined the British Commonwealth, didn't they?
I believe they have an application. They might have joined. They passed a law and making English the official second language of Rwanda.
So what we're dealing with is really a larger conflict here.
And it's certainly a symptom of something bigger, because you say to yourself, why was that necessary? You know, if you're sensitive to these things, if you have, particularly your educated class, deals in Kinyarwanda and French, and then you say, no, now everything will be in English, that's regarded in some quarters as a kind of racial or ethnic cleansing, because you're basically eliminating those people and putting them at a kind of a big disadvantage. So, it's treated lightly. Stephanie Nolan, writing in the Globe, you know, she just blew it off as, oh, what's the difference? Well, it'd be a big difference if you were a university professor and functioning in French. You're in for a nightmare. And we've had this experience in our own country, and we have bad blood here over Ontario's decision to stop teaching in French in the 1800s, and that led to really bad feelings. So,
indeed,
people should not think that's an amusing or small matter. Well, it's an arrogant, crazy thing if you think about it. Why would the power need to do that? And well, the answer is in somewhere. Is where you suggest, which is great powers want that. I think the Americans who speak only English wanted to make their life more convenient, so they told him you know, make English your official language, and then anybody we deal with will have to talk to us in English.
The way our media has been covering it, in many ways they've been making the wholehearted move towards the Anglosphere by Rwanda into a sour grapes issue for France. So they make a big deal about how France is upset that Rwanda was moved away under Kagame. And now there's this trial going on, this issue at least, over Rose Kabuyi.
Yes.
Because a member of Rwanda's government, she was, what, the mayor of Kigali and an army officer in, yes. in the RPF.
And a former Ugandan lieutenant in the Ugandan army.
Oh, well, again, they all harken back to the same fraternity.
What does they say? The proverb says the tongue returns to the aching tooth.
Now she's being held. I think, did she go through Germany to France? I don't remember the exact details. Now they want to question her in her role over events including the shooting down of the airliner that begat
the
conflict.
The genocide, as they call it, yes.
Yes. So now they've turned us in our media into an issue of France being upset and making a big deal about things, and that the impression you get from reading our news coverage is that France should just let it go, let events take their course, and let Africa and Rwanda move on, basically. But other news articles are suggesting things are coming to a head. Is France going to accuse other Rwandan leaders of participation in crimes? Now Rwanda is accusing France. So what's
yes.
happening here?
I think where we could be helpful there is to point out something that everybody is forgetting. And that is, here's the Rwanda position today. And as far as I know, the Americans are standing behind them saying amen. But the Rwandans are saying the charge against Rose Kabuyi in a French court for participation in the murder of two African presidents, that's just France trying to cover its own crimes. And so in the year 2008, they're bringing her to court to cover their own crimes. And that this is all made up just because Rwanda has accused France of crimes. So they say, you see, you're just doing this. Well, they're forgetting something. In 1996, there was an investigation by UN personnel which concluded that the RPF had shot down the plane. So what the French are accusing Rose of was previously accused. That accusation is a long... It's more than 10 years old, and it was UN investigators who came to the same conclusions. So for them to say now, oh, look, France is just doing this to cover themselves, well, as I say, they forgot something. This accusation was out there more than 10 years ago by UN investigators. And by the way, of course, your listeners need to know that after they had done their preliminary investigation, identified the witnesses, and said that most of the evidence pointed at the RPF. They were told to conclude their investigation, but they did do it. And they were ready to make charges if it was necessary, but they were told, forget about it. And but it is a matter of historical record.
Well,
people could go to my website, taylor-report.com, and you can read a detailed account of how that happened under the name Hourigan.
Yeah, it seems that this conflict between France and Rwanda's current leadership might be becoming to a head in some ways. Before we go, do you think there's anything we should look for in future coverage of the Congo? Because I don't know how it's going to be discussed in our media from now onwards.
I think we're going to see a battle over narratives, and they're trying to establish the same narrative for Congo that they used in Rwanda. And they used in Uganda when the war started in 1990 for the old timers here. They want to establish a narrative that Mr. Nkunda is simply a Tutsi who maybe he's not the nicest person. He might be guilty of occasional crime, but he's trying to protect the Tutsi minority from the Interahamwe, the bad Hutus. So this is basic, and that's what lays behind this. They're going to say that he's there because the Congolese government is racist towards the Tutsi, and therefore he has to be the one. He's self-appointed, and he gets armed by Rwanda to do this. He's got to be the one to control all of East Congo and to keep them safe. And that was what Paul Kagame defined his role as. He was going to... The Hutu were racist and homicidal, and he had to protect the Tutsi. This has always been the story. But one of the device they used to protect the Tutsi is the gun. They do not want to use democracy. If you use democracy, they say, you see, that'll lead to bad things, because after all, the Tutsi are a tiny minority and tend to be rather, well, more better off than their neighbors. So form an army, take over the whole country and say, because you treat us badly, or that's a claim, not a fact, but you say that, and then you get to run the whole country forever, because you can't trust democracy.
And we're just supposed to forget about Rwanda invading Congo several times, talking about creating
they
a buffer
had to
state.
That. You know, when they invaded the first couple of times, remember, they attacked United Nations refugee camps, and that was treated as though that was they were liberators. People said, isn't that great? They're shelling with artillery refugee camps, because after all, the bad Hutus are in those refugees.
Right, and they
camps.
Said those were millions of people that were refugees, but they said they were all
people
bad.
Died, they were driven in the forest, they died of exposure.
They're getting what they deserved.
Huh?
They were getting what they deserved, according to some news accounts in the West.
Gurevich thought they were getting what they deserved, I remember that. But they always said, oh, you see, we're looking for the bad Hutu. Well, they're looking for the bad Hutu, and they take the diamonds and the uranium and
well, they tend to find
the
them in
those, and go home.
Yeah, it's always the mineral-rich areas that you find the army being deployed.
And the UN plays a particularly nefarious role, because they always say, "Oh, we're here to try to keep everything calm." But actually, what they're trying to do is prevent Congo from winning, because if you went back to a classic encounter of states, the state that was attacked has a right to defend itself. But the UN is between the Congolese and their ability to secure their own borders. And they're going to increase, on the request of the British, the number of soldiers. And the real goal there is to make sure that the Congo never controls its own eastern portions of the country and its own resources. And they'll always say they're trying to help. But this, we're back to Tolstoy's line, you know, the master classes will do anything for the oppressed and the poor, except get off their back.
Well, Phil, thanks very much for this.
Mm-hmm.
This is definitely
my pleasure.
Come into the fore, this issue about the Congo, so people can always...
More of it.
Yeah. We can tune into your website, I suppose, as well, at Taylor-Report, for further updates about the Congo and what's happening in regard to this invasion and the trials over the Rwandan government leaders.
Good.
Okay, well, thanks very much then, Phil.
Okay, thank you.
I'll catch
All
you
right.
later. Bye-bye. And that was Phil Taylor, or host of the Taylor Report on CIUT 89.5 FM. His program runs Mondays at 5 to 6 p.m., and you can find his website, www.taylor-report.com.